Great. So I've put back here the last slide of the first speaker, or what I could retranscribe from it, because I'm very fortunate to have had such a great introduction to this talk. So 2 points from the last talk of Karina Slabusch's talk was, first, that Africa has a very complex demographic history and is probably not described by a single tree, which I agree with. And the second bullet point was, what we need now is rigorous testing of models with various appropriate summary statistics. So I also completely agree with that, so I changed the title of my talk to Testing Models of Early Human Evolution. I removed the rigorous because, you know, I'm doing my best, but it's hard to be completely rigorous here. Okay, so the introductions we had were oddly similar, so for the few people who might not have been there this morning, I'm just going to really quickly go through one slide here that argues that the archaeological evidence points to a complex history with occupation across the African continent, broadly inconsistent with a single radiation from a single part of Africa. One slide showing paleontological evidence with multiple crania also distributed across Africa, also broadly difficult to reconcile with a single human origins in one part of Africa radiating outwards. And also one slide showing, you know, human expansions out of Africa, which is broadly, you know, I mean, we've seen a couple of those already, showing these expansions of modern humans out of Africa, which is very consistent to the similar slide that was shown this morning, showing radiation out of Africa. And within Africa, for those who have photographic memory, you might notice that this history of Africa proposed by Brenna Henn in 2012 is different, in that in Brenna's paper, she was suggesting human origins in South Africa expanding northwards, whereas in Karina's talk this morning, we had the arrow pointing in the other direction, emphasizing the fact that the history of humans in Africa is still very hotly debated. Another aspect that, in my mind, points against the single tree-like origin was from another paper cited this morning, showing the estimates of divergence time between sand populations in southern Africa and other modern human populations. This is from this review paper from 2021, showing these estimates are really all over the place, right? There's some estimates pointing divergences as early as 500,000 years ago, others pointing at divergences 100,000 years ago, and none of these estimates have narrow confidence intervals but are really inconsistent. So that seems to indicate that there's a problem in the way we're learning these models. There's all kinds of differences between how people have chosen to approach these inferences. But in this case, all these models in this review were renormalized to use the same molecular clock, the same mutation rate. So it's not just a difference in the choice of a parameter. There's something, in my mind, wrong going on with at least some of these estimates. Okay, so what might be going on? And so here's an image from a review by Shiki and Derrico, referring to another paper cited earlier this morning, describing two different conceptual models for what might be going on in Africa. One is the simpler model, often favored by geneticists, of a single origin with some branching going on, and maybe sometimes we had a couple of decorations, some migration arrows here and there. And the argument in this paper was that, well, probably this is not the right conceptual model for what happened in Africa. Maybe a better conceptual model would be something like this, where there were populations all the time, all around Africa, and maybe they went extinct sometimes, they exchanged migrants, you know, populations split and merged all through time going in a far and distant past. And I completely agree. I mean, it's hard to not agree with this argument. This is a much better conceptual model, and this is a silly model based on the evidence that we have. The problem with this model is that I don't know how to fit it to data. It's really complicated. There's many parameters. I don't even know where to start with this and to compare it with real data. And so what we decided to do was to do baby steps and start with this model and start adding more complexity to it, realizing that it's still a simple model and it's still too simple, but we're going to start testing multiple different ways of reticulating this model, of adding branches, and try to see what describes data best. Okay, and one of the things actually that we realized very quickly when we started to do this was that there's, even if we do baby steps, there's really many ways of adding branches, right? There's too many models to test. And so what we decided to do was to focus on reticulations that had been discussed in the anthropological literature in the hopes that this was going to capture some of the paleontological evidence, the archaeological evidence that archaeologists had taken into account in building these models. And so we were going to take these models that had been developed in that literature, translate them into genetics models language, models that we can test, and then try to go and see which one did best. And so this work was done primarily by Aaron Ragsdale. I mean, all the hard work of modeling was done by Aaron Ragsdale, who is now a prof at UW-Madison. And we worked heavily with Brenna Henn and Tim Weaver in defining the space of models we were going to consider to incorporate this anthropological perspective. Okay, so some possible models that had been proposed in this review by Brenna and Tim and collaborator. The first model we have is the recent expansion model that had already been discussed this morning as a model that does not really fit the data well, but that is a model where we imagine that we have a single ancestral modern human populations expanding through, in this case, we're going to focus on South Africa, West Africa, East Africa, and Europe. The reason we include Europe in here is because we know there has been Neanderthal introgression into the ancestors of present-day Europeans, and we wanted to incorporate the Neanderthal model genome in our models. Of course, this is not a complete depiction of what's happening in Africa, but that's a starting point. Okay, that's one model. Another model is we're going to imagine that there were populations around different regions of Africa, and when one population expanded throughout Africa, they might have met populations that were already there in different parts of Africa, right? So this is what's represented as these little branches here, might have been earlier divergences of populations occupying different parts of Africa, and then more recently, when a modern human has really started picking up in numbers, they might have been a single population that took over, but then admixed with local populations. That's the model. Another model is the archaic admixture model, where it's similar in its topology, but the difference is that we imagine that the populations that modern humans encountered are more deeply diverse. Maybe they're Neanderthal-like, maybe they're Homo naledi or something like that, like deeply diverse hominins that they might have met as they were expanding. So that's another model. And finally, there is the African multi-regional model, where we're going to imagine that there were modern human populations through Africa going back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, and that where the, if you trace the ancestry of modern day humans living in South Africa, in particular the Nama, we might imagine that their ancestry is still somewhat more closely related, you know, despite the admixture to these individuals who might have lived a long time ago. Now, there's different ways of interpreting this African multi-regional model, but that's the big picture of these models here. Now, these are still conceptual models here. When you look at actual modern-day populations, like their real recent demographic history is more complicated than that, so we have to actually start looking at, okay, so these are the conceptual models that people discuss in the anthropological literature. What data are we going to use to test these models? And so we use populations indicated here by arrows. So so Brenna Henn worked with communities in South Africa and collected new data for the Nama population, which is one of the, it's a Khoisan population that is fairly deeply diverse from other modern human populations in terms of their genetic differentiation. We have the Gumuz and the Oromo in Eastern Africa, the Mende in West Africa. We're going to also use, as I mentioned, the British population as an out-of-Africa population that has Neanderthal admixture, and then the Neanderthal genome from the Vindhya cave. And so what we're going to do now, and this is where it's a lot of work, is that we're going to try to use what we know about the recent history of these populations and the colonial history of admixture and so on, and build a recent history model and kind of plug it into all these different ancient history models and test all of these models and see how well we're doing against the data. Okay, so the general framework that we're going to use, this is very similar to many of the talks that people have the approaches that have been described in many of the talks. We're going to have humans whose DNA gets sequenced. From the sequence data, we measure observables like summary statistics. Now, on the other hand, we have a model which has lots of parameters, population sizes, migration rates, admixture events, and so on. And we're going to, from these models, we can predict what would be the expected observations, and we're going to compare the predicted observations to the observations, and we're going to update these parameters and these models until we find good agreement. And we're going to try to find, in the likelihood framework, which model has the highest likelihood, right? So how which model explains the data the best in some way. Okay, so we have models, and these are models that we can test because they're specified, they have parameters. We can put them in a simulator like MS Prime and generate predictions. The challenge with this is that these simulations are great, and there's been great progress in simulation. You can simulate whole genomes in a couple of hours, even under these complicated models. But as Paul mentioned, it's not quite fast enough yet, because if we want to test hundreds of models with lots of summary statistics, and you have to compute all these summary statistics and compare them to the model, you just can't do it. It's just not practical. So we have to find a faster way of testing all these models against genetic data, and this is where we do some math. So we're going to use mathematical tricks to try to speed this process up a lot. And this is math that many of you have been using, and many of you will be familiar with. So the first, we're going to use recursions. So very simple equations in population genetics that tell us about the evolution of some summary statistics over time, where we don't need to simulate entire populations. We just get exactly the quantity we want, and we can track it over time. And the most well-known equation for this relates to the expected number of differences between two copies of the genome in a population. And there's a very famous equation that says that if you want to know the probability that two individuals in your population carry different alleles, you can condition on the state of their parents. You can say there's two possible things that can happen. Either the two individuals share the same parent, and that happens with probability 1/2n, and in that case, they carry the same allele, barring mutation. And with probability 1 - 1/2n, they have a distinct parent, and they will carry different alleles if their parent carried different alleles. Right? That's the only way you can carry different alleles. So to get a different allele, you need to draw different parents with this probability, and then you need to have your parents carry different alleles, but that's just the probability that the two individuals from the previous generation carry different alleles. So it's the same quantity, pi, the probability of finding differences, in the parental generation. And so we get this equation that the diversity, the pairwise differences at time t, is the pairwise differences at time t minus 1 multiplied by this factor 1 - 1/2n, equation 1 in many population genetics textbooks. Okay, so this is great. We can add mutation to this model. We can say, wait a second, there's another way of being different. You could say that maybe your two parents carried the same allele, but one of them passed on their genomes with a mutation. And so if you do this bookkeeping, you say, either you drew two parents who had different alleles, or you drew two parents with the same allele, but then one of them had a mutation. And so you could write a recursion for this measure of genetic diversity over time. And now instead of having to simulate a million individuals for 3 billion base pairs, you have to keep track of one number, pi, and you can solve this over time, which is very, very efficient. Just for wrapping up my little population genetics tutorial here, one of the very, very famous uses of this equation was to say, well, what happens now if you wait a long time and you wait for equilibrium to occur, that things don't change anymore in a population staying at constant size, and there's this mutation drift equilibrium that tells you that pi, the number of pairwise differences, is equal to 4 times the population size times the mutation rate. Very famous result. This is great. Okay, so these equations had this particular use. Of course, because we have this recursion over time, we don't have to request equilibrium. We can just say, well, let n be a function of time. And now, for example, if we have this particular history of population sizes over time with two bottlenecks occurring here and here, you can just solve this equation and say this is the dynamic process of pairwise differences over time in that population. So this is very nice. We can calculate this very efficiently and very, very fast. The problem is that at the end of this, you get very little information, relatively. You get one number, pairwise differences, right? It's not quite enough for us to learn complex models. And for the record, all the tree-mix plots that we've seen in many of these talks, they use this equation. They use that formula, essentially, to rapidly calculate patterns of diversity. But it's not quite enough information to reconstruct these more complex models because you have this one number differences. So we tried to generalize this. And to do this, we realized that there's a similar recursion that occurs if you track haplotypes at two loci. And that recursion was identified by Hill and Robertson in 1966 and 1968, which I didn't know when I started this project. Can people just kind of generally nod if they're familiar with these equations? Like just vaguely move your head. So most people don't know these equations, right? So again, I didn't know them either, but you might notice that D is just the covariance in allele frequencies at two different loci. And so you can measure it by counting how often the ancestral alleles are in the same haplotypes and subtract the number of times the ancestral alleles are in different haplotypes. And it's a measure of linkage disequilibrium. And you can see that this first equation is very similar to the recursion we had before. D, the covariance, decreases over time. Fine. But D is boring because it tends to be zero on average. So it's not super informative. So in 1968, Hill and Robertson found a recursion for D square, which is the measure people typically use in genome-wide association studies to look at linkage disequilibrium. And so they were very, very useful formula, which very rapidly Ota and Kimura realized they could play the same trick of equilibrium, waiting for things to not change, and find from this that in a small population you have more linkage disequilibrium, and you should carry your GWAS in small populations if you have a chance in the early days when you didn't have access to sequencing data for cheap. Okay, what we were interested in at that point was to ask, okay, what happens then when you try to understand LD variation across populations? Because in genome-wide association study and risk prediction, one of the big problems we have is that the variants we associated with disease might not be the causal variants, and they don't work very well to predict disease in other populations from which you didn't learn you didn't run your GWAS in. And one of the reasons is this pattern of differences in linkage disequilibrium, meaning these covariances between variants vary across populations. This is really complicated, so don't worry if I lost you here with this two levels of covariances. We wanted to understand how genetic linkage disequilibrium varied across population. And so Aaron figured out that you could generalize the Hill and Robertson equations to two populations or more populations by playing the same bookkeeping trick I said. Like, okay, either you pick the same parent or you pick different parents or you have a recombination or like you just do bookkeeping. It's pretty straightforward, but long. And then you get this recursion for these particular statistics. One of them is D squared, which is the LD in each of the populations. One of them is the dot product of LD across different populations. And there's a bunch of other statistics that nobody cares about. And so so we did that. So he got this equation, which can handle multiple populations, drift, migration, recombination, mutation rate, and can generate these predictions for hundreds of statistics in like a second, right? So this is very nice. And so we went back and revisited this model, this out of Africa model that we've been refitting every time we had a new data set. Looking at, again, the out-of-Africa event, West African population, the Yoruba, CEU, European ancestry in the US, and Chinese, Han Chinese from Beijing, and checked whether, using this recursion, that model did a good job at capturing LD variation across population. And that was the motivation for the project initially, because if that model doesn't do a good job at capturing LD variation across populations, it's going to be a bad guide to understand GWAS and prediction variation across populations. So the first thing he did here is to look at D squared. Does this model describe LD within populations well? Dots are data. There's error bars there. They're very small error bars because we have a lot of data. And lines are model predictions. So pretty good, right? I mean, it's a pretty good fit. So then he went and looked at this the covariance of LD across populations, where there was some trepidation there. Does this model do a good job at that? And the answer is yes, it does a pretty good job. It describes these patterns pretty excellently. So I was both reassured and a bit disappointed. And then, okay, so when we're there, we're like, okay, we have these two statistics, but there's also these other statistics that nobody cares about. They just come in the math in our recursion. Like, we didn't have any reason to look at these statistics, but we had them in the model. We had computed them. So we're like, okay, we can look at them in the data and see if the model agrees. And so this is this particular, the third statistic, which shows the model prediction and the data, and there's a really big disagreement. And I'll again mention there's an error bar here, they're very small, and this is a log scale. So these are very, very large difference. The model does a terrible job at describing the statistic. So what is the statistic? Well, it has this mathematical form here. I'm not going to go into details because I'm running way behind, but it's measuring positive linkage between uncommon variants. So if you have rare variants in high LD, this is going to be high. And so one of the ways to generate that pattern is to have a model like this, where you have one branch that's isolated, accumulates mutations, there's admixture, and all of a sudden, in your population, you have a bunch of rare variants in high LD. Okay, so that makes sense, and so maybe we should add archaic admixture to our model. So we first added, of course, a Neanderthal branch, admixing in the ancestors of Eurasian, and that fixed our problem for the Eurasians here, obviously not for the Yoruba, who did not get any gene flow from the Neanderthal. And so we said, oh, well, why not add an other branch of archaic admixture here, because we know how to do that. And now we fit these parameters, and here we found, okay, great, great pattern, great fit. So clearly, there's another archaic human, maybe in Africa, admixing with modern humans. And of course, then we can go back to this slide and ask, okay, so who might be this archaic humans? Again, is it Homo naledi maybe here? Is it Homo heidelbergensis? Or who might be a representative of this? Okay, so that's where we were at that point. But again, getting back to this original statement, we need rigorous testing of maybe more than just one model and one alternative model. And so I want to get back to my four models that I presented here and so make the statement, okay, we kind of rejected this model, but what about these other explanation models that can also explain the data? So again, this is where Aaron did so much work, testing all these models, setting them all up with all these different recent history. I'm not going to have to go into very much detail about exactly how we set up these models. I'm just going to show you two of the models that fit the data well. They're very rich models. They're fairly complicated. Each of these little letters is a migration rate that was fit in the model. So it's a crazy number of parameters, obviously. So we're going to have problems potentially with model misspecification and so on. So that's why we tried a whole bunch of different models. And let's say this is the model or that is the model, but just here's what's common to all the models that describe the data well. And here's a couple of things that you might notice if you're very skilled at looking at these kinds of diagrams. If I look at the recent past, like in the last maybe 100,000 years, things are very consistent, right? So these histories, split times, mergers, migration rates, they're pretty consistent across these different models. And so we seem to have a pretty good handle in terms of model fitting within the space of models we considered in describing the recent history of these populations. The other observation is what happens in the distant past. It's also common among all the models that fit the data well, which is that we find structure going back all the way to something like a million years ago, so really deep in the past. But these stems have ongoing migration between them, such that they end up not being extremely diverged from each other, right? So it's not like we had a separation of an archaic human and a modern humans that don't interbreed for a very long time and suddenly meet again. It's more like an isolation by distance model with relatively weak differentiation between these populations. And one way to measure this is, for example, by looking at these patterns of pairwise difference between populations. So if you take two modern human individuals from more or less anywhere in the world, you're going to find about one difference every 1,000 base pairs between haploid copies of the genome. If you take humans and Neanderthal, you're going to find more like 15-16%, I mean 60% more differences. And if you look at the differentiation between these stems, what we find is something like in between these two things, but much closer to the range of differentiation between modern human populations, right? So the hypothesis here, if you believe these models that fit the data well, is that there was population structure in the past, but the structure was not nearly as strong as that of human and Neanderthal, and it's almost consistent with the level of diversity we have in the population today, right? It's a little, these stems are a little bit more differentiated, but if we believe that genetic pairwise differences between individuals or population correlate with morphological differentiation between individuals and population, the prediction of these models would be that these different stems would not be very morphologically different from each other. So if we look at the morphological record, and I kind of jumped ahead a couple of slides, but I wouldn't look for who these different contributors are in very morphologically different humans like Homo naledi and modern humans, but in more similar remains. Okay, so if I get back though to my four models that I had we had set up in the beginning, the recent expansion, and these other three, what can we say? Well, firstly, as this morning, we can probably reject the recent expansion model. It's just really like it does qualitatively wrong, like it doesn't describe the data at all. Well, how about the other models? Well, I will argue that we can kind of reject the African multi-regional, at least the simplest interpretation I gave this morning, because even though the structure dates back a million years, but the structure that's visible in the present day population structure only dates back to about 100,000 years. And if you try to trace back the ancestry of the Nama, the Mende, and so on back in time, and you see, like, did one of the stem contribute more to one population versus the other, they really both contributed about the same amount of genetic material. I mean, there's small differences. But it's not like stem 2 is ancestral to South Africa and stem 1 is ancestral to East Africa or West Africa. It's all really mixed, right? So it doesn't seem in these models that there's persistence of population cohesion over this long period of time. Is it archaic admixture? I would argue that it's probably not, because there's not really an archaic human or distant relative that admixed into the population. And finally, is it a recent expansion with regional persistence? Well, I say we can also say it's not really that, because there's structure going all the way back to a million years. So, success! We have rejected all the models. And you know, the real model is more complicated than that, right? The best fit model. Okay, so the best fit model is more complicated, which kind of makes sense, right? We kind of expect human history to also be idiosyncratic and not necessarily fit perfectly within one nice box. So of course, I don't know whether this is the correct model, but it's a model that describes the data really well. Again, if this is what I was saying earlier, if I were to look for where, you know, which fossils might represent these different ancestral branches, I would look for things that are not too different from modern humans. And they might come from different parts of Africa, of course. Aaron did a lot of work here trying also to take these models and validate them against other statistics that people, including people in this room, had used previously to argue for archaic admixture in Africa, including the conditional SFS here, and showing that this model that we fit using these LD pattern described all these other statistics as well or better as the archaic admixture model, even though we haven't used this particular information in our model fitting. So lots of validation. So at least what I can say is that this model is as good as the archaic admixture model in describing genetic data. And I have 1 minute left. So the main take home from my perspective is that it looks like there's structure in the human lineage going back at least 600,000 years, probably more. And these different stems contributed differently to different modern human populations, but not like, there's lots of mixing, right? The proportions are like 50%, 45%, 55%, you know, mixing in different populations and the other way in the other population. It's not systematic over time. There's ongoing gene flow across these populations. Of course, we don't know whether it's really constant gene flow or whether it's sporadic over, you know, multiple stages over 600,000 years. I'm repeating myself. And now what we're doing is we're trying to ask what happens when you add selection to this picture, right? Because you can argue that this model here of population structure is very similar. It differs in parameters when you contrast it to the archaic admixture model. If I just set this migration rate A to zero, now we suddenly have something that looks like an archaic admixture model.
But I'll argue that there's a couple of interesting differences. So if you imagine that you have a selective sweep occurring, right, at some point in the early modern human history, it's going to look very different if you have ongoing gene flow, like how the adaptation is going to work, versus what would happen in a model of archaic gene flow. We've all seen it with the Neanderthal. There's tons of adaptive introgression. There's tons of negative selection against introgression. And I would imagine that if you have ongoing gene flow, the adaptation picture would look very different, because we wouldn't expect to have this dramatic event that all of a sudden tons of selection should be observed in the human history, right? Things should be much more occur much more sequentially and potentially in different parts of Africa, which I think is kind of consistent with what we're seeing in the paleontological record. I'm out of time, so I will stop here and take questions.